KPCW News time is 8:06. Okay, you're listening to the Local News Hour. Let's find out what we have in store for our weather this weekend. On the phone, I have Cedric Hayes with ABC4. I missed you the last couple weeks. Cedric, welcome back.
Well, thank you. It's good to be back. And, of course, it's good to start the weekend off with some good news for folks here when it comes to the weather out there. So we're going to have a lot of sunshine in place for us in Park City. Today, we're going to see these temperatures warming up into the mid-60s this afternoon. So today is definitely your pick day to get outside and enjoy the nice weather as to go into the weekend, because significant changes are on the way. Now, the Heber Valley looking at lots of sunshine as well, with high temperatures climbing into the lower 70s this afternoon. So just some fantastic weather to be outside. Now, I will caution you, make sure that you get that sunscreen SPF 15 or greater today. Otherwise, you could burn in less than 15 minutes here with the UV index in the very high category. It's around 9 today. So that's just something to kind of be aware of, and lather that sunscreen on. Lather it on twice. Won't actually hurt at all today. All right, as we go into your weekend, Saturday, we're going to be seeing sunshine to start the weekend. Temperatures will kick off in the Heber Valley in the upper 30s. We'll be in the low 40s there in Park City for your Saturday morning. By Saturday afternoon, we'll see those highs climbing close to 70 degrees, and we'll see highs in the mid to upper 70s in the Heber Valley. So our Saturday's pretty nice, but we will start to see clouds on the increase by Saturday afternoon. We'll also see some of those gusty winds picking up out of the south as well, and that's ahead of a stronger low pressure and front that's going to be moving our way as we go into your Sunday. So Saturday night, look for cloudy skies. Could see a couple of passing showers, with overnight lows only dropping down into the low 40s by the time we wake up on your Sunday morning. But as we go throughout your Sunday afternoon, look for slightly cooler temperatures, with highs only in the low 60s for Park City and highs only in the upper 60s for the Heber Valley. But the real story will be the increasing chances for showers and even a couple of rumbles of thunder possible as we see our next storm system moving in. So plan on some wet conditions, some unsettled conditions going for us here as we go into our Sunday afternoon. And the problem with this next storm system is it's going to be a slow mover, which means that it's just going to kind of meander across the state over the weekend into early next week. So we'll have a good chance of scattered showers and storms on your Sunday, and we'll bring back that good chance of scattered showers and storms even for your Monday with even cooler temperatures. So highs will only be in the mid-50s for Park City on your Monday, with highs only around 60 degrees for the Heber Valley. And again, both days, Sunday and Monday, a pretty high chance of showers and thunderstorms at times. Now, as we go into your Tuesday, we'll start to lower those rain chances a little bit, but still expect some unsettled weather conditions. High temperatures will still only be around 60 in the Heber Valley on your Tuesday, with highs only in the mid-50s for Park City. So again, still some cooler conditions with unsettled conditions going through your Tuesday. And then by Wednesday, we hopefully will start to dry things out, with 30s in the morning and highs returning back to the 60s with partly cloudy skies. So let's enjoy today, because unsettled conditions are on the way by the second half of the weekend.
All right, Cedric, thanks for joining us, and you have a good weekend.
You have a great one as well. Thank you so much.
You're listening to the Local News Hour. Coming up, I'm going to speak with Summit County Democratic Party Chair Rory Swenson, who is joining me in the studio. Then Councilmember Ryan Dickey will stop by to discuss the two city council meetings that took place this week. We're going to finish our hour. It's going to be an interesting conversation. We're going to talk with Justin Hibbert of the St. Mary's Church about the role the Pope plays in the everyday life of Catholics, a timely topic during this time of transition. Stay tuned. Well, last Friday, I had a conversation with Ari Ioannidis. He's the chair of the Summit County Republican Party. Today, we're going to get to hear from the other side of the aisle, as I am joined in the studio by Rory Swenson. He's the chair of the Summit County Democrats. Morning, Rory. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So, Rory, you've been the chair for about a year. What did you envision as the role for the chair when you first sought the position, and how has that role changed, if at all?
So, I've been involved with the Summit County Democratic Party for about 9 years now, in various roles in the executive committee, as vice chair, and then as a state committee representative. And last year, our then chair had to move to Colorado, and so I assumed that role. So I really didn't expect it at the time. I was surprised at the amount of organizing and effort was involved. I really coasted as a vice chair, I think. But it's been very rewarding. It's been challenging at times, but you know, really, it's just a desire to contribute. It's a desire to be involved. It's a desire to make a difference.
You know, I'm not sure people would have a real idea of what the chair of a local party does. Can you share a little bit about that?
So a lot of it is organizing in the off years, like this year was the organizing convention. And then in the even years, we do the nominating convention as well as the caucuses. But between all of that effort, a lot of it is just representing the Democratic Party with the county. It's working with recruiting candidates. This year we have municipal elections coming up, and so we're looking, while those are nonpartisan races, and we don't officially get involved, and we don't donate, we don't do things like that, we do want to try and find candidates that can serve at the local level. We also want to recruit people to serve on boards and planning commissions, really to build a bench of individuals that want to serve, want to contribute to the community, want to make the community better. And then when we get to the partisan races, I mean, the county level is partisan races. I don't think they should be. Because again, at local politics, the partisanship it shouldn't really play that big of a role. We're neighbors, right? We're all trying to make the community better, and we just want to find the best candidates for those roles.
What are some of the local issues that are of particular interest to the Democrats as Democrats?
It's really the same. As the Republicans. It's the growth. It's how do we handle growth? How do we handle the infrastructure needs? How do we handle the green space and water rights? It really does break down at the local level to quality of life and how do we manage the growth? How do we make sure that the communities are great places to live and how do we maintain that in the future?
You know, without overgeneralization, which is always a problem, can you give us a sense of where on some of those issues one might legitimately perceive a difference in philosophy between you and the Summit County Republicans?
At the local level?
There's nothing intuitively to me that comes, you know, that's obvious, but you've probably thought about this more than I have.
You know, I really stand by the idea that we want to find candidates that appeal to a broad range. You know, elections are really won in the broad middle, and that's where most people are. And so when we're working with candidates, we're looking to develop people that can appeal to that broad middle and that can address those local issues. I really don't think there's a whole lot of daylight at the local level, and my concern is that the division and the partisanship at the national level, especially over the last decade, we've seen it filter down at the state level with the Republican supermajority here, and now we're seeing it start to filter into the local level. And I think that is ultimately a negative effect for Summit County and for the municipalities.
Okay, because I guess historically, while the county level council seats were, I guess they've been partisan in a formal sense for a long time.
Yes.
They didn't feel all that partisan in terms of the way people approached it historically.
Historically, yes.
Okay. I want to talk about HB 356.
Yes.
First of all, again, for those who don't speak those letters like you and I do, what was HB 53, that, HB 356, and how has the party been involved in its efforts?
So the HB 356 was legislation introduced at the state legislature by a representative from South Jordan. This is an effort to change the form of government that the county operates under from a five-member at-large council to a five-member districted council. This was lobbied for, and this is where I talk about some of the partisanship coming in. It was lobbied for by the Summit County Republican Party. I know that they've been frustrated with the election results in the past elections. But it's supposed to district it so that the east side can get better representation. I think it is actually counterproductive, and we're going to go into a special session, I believe in June. I'm not positive on that, to correct unintended consequences. Now, that basically means that when the state legislature passed this, it also inadvertently affects Wasatch County, which is a 7-member council with 5 district seats and 2 at-large. It would force them also to go to 7 districted seats and redistrict the entire county. That happens to be a Republican county, and so they have to figure out how to ease the effects on Wasatch County while still forcing Summit County to a 5-member districted council.
Now, I've heard principal arguments in favor of 356 that by redistricting in that way, you sort of give voters who would otherwise sort of never, as a practical matter, have a voice. What's wrong with moving to a districted election system in Summit County?
I actually don't think it's completely wrong. So if I do believe in having representation from every area. And we actually, in the Democratic Party, we actually recruit and really push to try and find East Side candidates. And we've done that. In my time on the executive committee, we've had Doug Clyde from the Camas area. We currently have Tawny Hansen from the Colville area. We value that, and we think that's important. The issue that I personally have, I'm a resident of Colville. And currently, I have 5 votes for 5 council members, and I have 5 points of accountability when issues come up. Now, if we district to 5, that takes my 5 votes and every other resident of the county to 1 vote every 4 years. We have 1 person to lobby, 1 person to call. I think that is actually a less representation than what we currently have. Now, if we want to address the East Side, I'm speaking to East Side residents right now. If we do a 3-2 split with 3 districts and 2 at large, then that guarantees that no matter what issue comes up for which locality, you have your district representative and 2 at large, you have a majority you can actually lobby. If we look at the population and how the population is centered in Summit County, South Summit and 5 districts, South Summit area would likely get a district. Park City and Park City proper and surrounding areas would get one. The Colville, Hennifer, Wanship, Hoytsville will have to extend into Tollgate, Promontory, and part of Snyderville to get the population. And then 2 seats will come out of the rest of Snyderville, Bear Hollow, assuming that it's a fair process, right? That's basically you'll have 3 seats in the west side. And 2 seats on the east side. We'll forever be a minority on the council. Now, we will have our representative, but only 1. We've shown that we can elect east side residents to the council in an at-large system, and a 3-2 split gives us the ability to possibly capture another one.
Now, Rory, actually, you mentioned something really interesting, this notion of, a 3 district to 2 at-large. In the special session, is that something that you think might be at play?
I honestly have no idea. We don't have a whole lot of influence at
really?
The state level. Yeah, imagine that. But it seems like the most elegant solution to me, especially to protect Wasatch County, if that's what they want to do.
And you also mentioned something else in passing, which is you said if it's a fair drawing. There's certainly been criticism leveled at the state legislature for the way that it likes to draw districts at a state and congressional level. Do you have some concerns that there could be an attempt to sort of really politicize the drawing of districts?
I really hope that doesn't happen. The other concern is the makeup of the district and commission. But on this bill, it's the mayors of each municipality and one from the unincorporated. Well, the vast majority of residents of Summit County are living in unincorporated areas. And so that's really underrepresenting those residents. And, I would like to see a little bit fairer representation from each of those areas. And, you know, I would issue a challenge to my counterparts on the Republican side. You know, this is an important thing, and I agree that representation is critically important. If we really, truly value that, if you look at the state level, Summit County has not had a representative or a senator that lives in Summit County since Mel Brown. We have been gerrymandered and split up so much that we just don't have anybody here that is a resident that gets elected at the state level. I would say, let's work together. Let's lobby so that whether it's the Better Boundaries lawsuit or whether it's the next census, Summit County deserves local representation as well, and we need to see that changed.
Yeah, this goes to that larger issue of the way in which congressional and state legislative districts are drawn in the state. And as you know, that is proceeding through the courts to as a result of the Better Boundaries lawsuit. Interestingly enough, last week I asked Ari Ioannidis, after having this discussion, about whether he was in support of an independent redistricting committee, and he actually said that those principles apply at the state level.
I'd love to work with him on that.
Which I found interesting. Okay, you recently spoke at a protest in City Park. What was your message that day?
So my message, it was twofold. Number one, we have very serious challenges nationwide. It's only been 100 days of the new administration, and wow, what a whirlwind. And, you know, we're facing some very dark times. And I think that citizens need to make their voice heard. That's part of the reason we had the rally. We want to encourage that and speak very strongly to defend rights and to defend our way of life. But the second part of that was that it really is up to us and how we approach our neighbors at the local level to try and reduce the temperature and try and provide a refuge for them to perhaps change their mind. I really have a lot of faith in Americans, and I don't think that a lot of the voters that voted for this administration really truly intended what is happening now. And my point is that if we have an attitude and we come as an attack, the natural response is to dig in your heels and be defensive. What I'm asking at the local level is just simply ask questions. Just simply speak to each other and try and build those bridges. Sun Tzu in The Art of War, the Golden Bridge, you don't need to win a battle by destroying each other. All you need to do is provide a bridge that allows people to make other decisions and together actually perhaps change things in the next elections.
It's been a while, I believe, since a Democrat has won a Utah statewide election. Since Matheson. I'm not sure. What activities are you engaged in to try to change that agenda, to try to look to be able to possibly elect a Democrat at the state level sometime in the next few years?
Well, you're seeing a shift in a lot of the makeup of Utah voters. If you look at the elections, Utah was actually a red state that moved more to the purple in the last election. More to the middle. I think that the nature of the drift in the parties at the national level favors the Democrats, favors moderates. When I say Democrats, you know, we're a big tent. We have the far left and the progressives. We have the center left and the center. I do think we can attract even the center right. If we focus on issues that affect people and really stop with the culture wars and the divisiveness, I think we can actually make some good progress, especially in this state.
And I suppose if in fact there are new congressional districts drawn by the 26th election, that would probably change the calculus substantially.
It would, yes.
Okay. Um, Do you expect to be involved in similar events like the protest in the future? Have you got plans to try to do you think those things are impactful?
I do. You know, we had 200 or so people out in Summit County. But what's important from my perspective is to keep that momentum going without burning people out. So it's a delicate balance. We want to support people and we want to encourage them to speak out, but this is going to be a long haul. I mean, we're looking at some dark times ahead, and you have to pace yourself, and we don't want to burn people out with that as well. So we'll continue to do those events. We're feeling our way through it. These are interesting times.
All right, Roy, anything else you want to touch on before we go?
No, I would really encourage anybody listening that, you know, try and split the national partisanship and the local issues in your mind, and let's work to try and maybe change things from the bottom up.
Okay. Rory Swenson, chair of the Summit County Democratic Party, providing a bookend to my conversation I had last week with Ari Ioannidis of the Summit County GOP. Rory, thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
And the Park City Council held a special meeting last night, they held a special meeting on Monday and a regular meeting last night. Here with the debrief is Council Member Ryan Dickey. Let me remind you that Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Morning, Ryan.
Good morning.
Let's start with the special meeting on Monday. At that meeting, there was a reconsideration and ultimately the rejection of ranked choice voting. Let's see, as I understand it, the meeting arose because Councilman Bill Sirocco announced at last Thursday's meeting that he had changed his mind on the subject based on introspection and new information, and he wanted to be reconsidered. Mayor Worrell characterized it as an ambush. You also had some strong words at the Monday meeting. What are your concerns about both the substance and the process?
Well, the first thing to say is, we got to move forward. So this issue's received a lot of attention, and I think actually KPC's reporting has been very good with sort of the TikTok. But big picture, our elections are the one thing. Elections are the one thing you just can't screw up as a city. It's the method by which we sit here and are allowed to make these decisions. So to keep it simple, we studied ranked choice voting over months. I've been advocating it going back to even before my own election. The council looked at all sorts of information, studies, put that information was on the record, it was in staff reports, and ultimately agreed to do ranked choice voting, announced it to the public, announced here are the rules of the election, and we moved on with really very little fanfare. I didn't see a whole lot of engagement with your stories, sort of a nothing burger. And then last Thursday, without warning, Councilmember Sirocco said he had new information about issues with tabulation under ranked choice voting, and wanted to have a special meeting within days to reconsider it. We held that meeting on Monday, and despite that meeting occurring during business hours, which is also unusual, we had many members of the public show up, overwhelmingly telling us they did not support changing the form of the election. And the majority of council, those three members, Sirocco, Rebell, and Parisian, decided they moved forward with changing the form of the election, accelerating the filing deadline by over 2 months. And that was that. So it just, I know for the public and certainly for members of council, and you heard from the mayor, sort of felt like that majority of council was not listening, but we took a vote and that was that.
There were vague allegations of conspiracies from both supporters and detractors. Do you have anything to say about whether there's more here than meets the eye?
Well, I don't know, and I don't want to, certainly question anyone's motives. And the salient fact here is Councilmember Sirocco referenced new information, and our professional staff asked to offer to review that information, to have it bring experts to the meeting. Those three members of council declined that offer, so we came to that Monday meeting just days later with really no new information. We requested that new information again. I asked for it multiple times, and the new information was, again, declined to be presented. So ultimately, it felt like the council making a significant decision to change its form of election with new information that was not shown to the public, and it was concerning.
And Councilman Sirocco also sort of tried to make it clear that from his perspective, his reasons included not just sort of an email regarding tabulated voting, which he ultimately concluded was not a major problem, but lots of other concerns that he reviewed. So that his perspective is, I thought about it some more.
And fair enough. He presented that perspective, right. And we all there's certainly votes I've taken that I've regretted, not just weeks and months later like this that I've regretted. I've gone home the same night and said, what was I thinking on that one? But back to elections. Elections are just something that we cannot create any doubt or lack of confidence in with the public. And if you think you made the wrong decision, sometimes you say, hey, this just, we're too close to an election. We're making a decision that seems to clearly benefit incumbents. And you just don't change the rules. And next time around, you don't do ranked choice voting again. So ultimately, this really wasn't about ranked choice voting. There'll be differences of opinion on that. There's lots of pros and cons. It's really about changing the rules of the elections in a special meeting with days warning based on new information that was not shown to the public.
Okay. Anything else on that topic?
I think we've talked enough about it, but it's important. I'm glad we talked about it, and now we got work to do.
Okay. Speaking of having work to do, the 224 bus rapid transit project was on the agenda last night. Where do we stand on that?
Yeah, so that project ultimately, this is a UDOT High Valley Transit project that comes into town on Highway 224. There's concerns on our council about the widening of the road. The road does need to be widened in town. Now, we're talking about a 5-foot, on each side widening of the road. So we're, 5 feet. This is, first and goal from the one. That's 5 feet. Nobody wants to see more pavement in town. So we asked to meet with UDOT, to speak about, talk with UDOT about changes to the project. The overriding concern in the federal granting environment is if you change requirements of a grant, all this federal money that's paying for it that's already come to us, do we have a chance of really sort of blowing up the project entirely? That's a big concern. I'm not willing to make changes to the project and to endanger it, but certainly we always want to try to make it better. And the second concern is, we have a little bit of a history here with UDOT of backing out of some things at the last second, and Park City has a little bit of a reputation. We know we need UDOT's help on 248. That's where the traffic is that we hear about from residents. And our zip code is Kearns Boulevard coming into town. We're going to need their help if we disrupt the project at the finish line. We want to make sure that we're viewed as making beneficial changes and not disrupting something that could cause problems where we need their help again.
And to zoom out a little bit, is the change we're talking about, as I understand it, that whether or not the road widening stops at a certain point coming into town?
That's right.
And where's that line where it might stop? Was it Bear Hollow or the canyons?
It's designed to stop sort of near Hotel Park City. When you look at the traffic today, what we see is the traffic frees up a lot the canyons. Yeah. And so, I after school drop off, I drive in on 224 every morning, and there's congestion, but you're actually sort of in free flow traffic, and it. I don't think it's going to be that way in 2050, but we actually don't know. We don't, there's a study that says that there's going to be a lot of traffic, but think of the variables from how much parking will be in town, what will happen to the base areas, how many people live here. It's hard to know, so it's a little bit of a question that you can't answer with science, but taking a gut check, do I believe that this piece of infrastructure that probably isn't wholly needed today in town, but that we might need in the future, and that we might not have another crack at, do I want to move forward with that infrastructure or say no to it and potentially wish I'd done that? Sort of similar to the bottleneck we have on 248. We sort of brought in UDOT. We said we want to widen the road. We have this bottleneck that's the cause of the problem. And then at the last minute, we said, no, we don't actually want the road widened. We still have the bottleneck, and UDOT remembers.
And yeah, that 248 project, that was about 5 years ago that that came in.
I think that was like 2017 or before I was around.
I don't want to talk, well, I know 248 wasn't on the agenda, but, you know, as I drive in down 248 and I look to my left and I see a massive construction project with housing and restaurants and shops, we're going to add, I assume that's going to add more cars and more traffic to that. What is the timeline for trying to get a changed 248?
The timeline really is ASAP. I mean, we're pushing on this. So we have our 248 corridor study, which is nearing its conclusion. Despite considering all sorts of modes of travel, I expect that study to say, hey, you need bus rapid transit. You don't need to, reinvent the wheel here. And we need a park and ride in that location. You saw us talk about that a couple meetings ago. Didn't really land the plane on the location, but ultimately we need we're going to need some sort of transit solution on 248 and a park and ride to keep cars out of town from visitors, and a place for employees and eventually commercial customers even of Main Street to be able to park and come in on fast, frequent transit.
Yeah, and again, you mentioned, you talked about that a few weeks ago, and people have been talking about it ever since, is probably around 2017. I think one of the frustrations with what happens in the city is how long it takes to actually get one of these things done. How can you bring a greater force to bear to try to get something where we actually put shovels in the ground in the next year?
It's a big question with probably a multi-layered answer, but you know, there's two pieces to it. Transportation broadly requires a lot of federal funding,
yeah.
And that takes a lot of time. But decisions can be made more quickly, and I think as a council, we really need to drive to decisions. I think sometimes we let the perfect be the enemy of the good, and can get in our own way. So we had a park and ride project before us on the Gordo site just a couple years ago, and council ultimately decided not to move forward with that as we went from one council to the next, and now we're back looking at sites. And that's not to disparage anyone's decision or analysis of the situation, but I think we can do a better job of maybe accepting some decisions of the past or accepting the options that are before us in the present and simply moving projects forward. And, if we get a project that's 80% perfect, it's sort of like building a house. You know, I tell people, you know, the only way to get the perfect house is to build it yourself. Except after you build a house, you look around and you go, man, I wish I'd done these things differently. So, yeah, we all do. So let's not let the perfect be the enemy of the good sometimes and try to push some things forward.
You know, given those frustrations, I don't know if you remember, but, 20 or 30 years ago, the federal government concluded that it couldn't ever close a military base because there were too many political considerations. So they offloaded that responsibility to an independent administrative body that wasn't having to answer to constituents. Is there some merit to something like that with some of these projects, where you sort of try to take the politics out of it by removing the council's input? This is a philosophical question that you're certainly not prepared for. But
no, we sort of do it, yeah. And with some success, sometimes not. I mean, in one sense, we do offload the decisions because we have professional staff who are transportation experts, and we hire consultants, and everyone makes fun of us. But we're bringing in people who know what they're talking about, and so it's incumbent upon us sometimes to simply listen to the expertise that's before us. And another thing we do is we'll create a committee. You know, we created a committee for our small grants project this year, and you heard us talking about PC TOTS last night. But then if we're going to create a committee of citizens and offload the decision, sometimes you got to accept the recommendation of the committee, and sometimes we're not good at that either. Yeah. It seems like sometimes we can't get the politics out of it. But, you know, these aren't really political issues. Yeah. They're really just decision points. Where a park and ride goes isn't a right decision or a left decision. It's just, where are we going to put down pavement and have people park and have a great experience and get into town? It's complicated, yeah. But sometimes I think we're making it a little too complicated.
There was a report on the potential of the, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, Mawinney?
Mawinney.
Mawinney. Sounds like a, anyway, Mawinney. It sounds like what my horse says. For a new senior center. Now, that's the lot across the street from the library?
That's right.
Okay. And what was the presentation? This would be the potential for the new senior center. And this would be an alternative to trying to modify the existing site.
That's right.
Okay. What did you learn, and what do you think would, do you think this has got a good potential for being a successful option?
I think it does. And ultimately, the council decided to move forward with Mawinney as the site. There's the parking lot, and there's a space next to it that's currently a vacant lot. It has some green space on it, so that's a challenge. But ultimately, majority of council viewed that as the most attractive site to move forward to try to get the senior center done. You know, where we've been is in the location of the current senior center on Woodside, trying to do, started out as a senior center and senior housing. We ran into challenges with, you can't use LIHTC specifically for seniors, so then it was going to be simply affordable housing. And just those 50 units of affordable housing became really expensive, and it sort of sunk the project as this combination. But we still want to build a senior center, so the question is, it's a lot easier to build a box, so that's great. We can move forward to the senior center. Where do you put it? And there are challenges with the existing site, and there are challenges with Mawinney, and the council voted last night to move forward on Mawinney.
What would you consider to be a success in terms of the timeline from today till I see a shovel in the ground at Mawinney?
A success along the way to the shovel?
A success. How many months? From here to shovel, what would you deem to be success?
Oh my gosh, Roger. I have no idea how to answer that question.
A number.
But months. Give you a number of months. I don't know. Okay. I'm gonna politely punt on your question. I'm still getting over the breaking news that you have a horse. So I'm still processing that.
I don't actually have a horse.
Oh, okay, good. All right.
And I suppose the seniors would be thrilled to have that great access to the skate park.
We all know the seniors love to skate. It's a nice location. It's right on Park Avenue. It's across the street from transit, and it allows them to stay in their current location during construction.
Okay. All right. Anything else that we need to touch on from last night's meeting or Monday's meeting?
There's plenty. I'd say one thing I did want to mention is with this accelerated timeline now on voting, we've also accelerated the timeline on a candidate forum. So coming up on Tuesday, I believe at 5:30 in council chambers, if you're interested in running for election, we have two council seats and the mayor's race. We want all of our races to be competitive as possible, no matter who's in them. And so come show up, learn more about voting.
All right. We've been speaking with Ryan Dickey of the Park City Council. Ryan, thanks for being here this morning.
Thanks, Roger.
I should note that at last night's City Council meeting, Councilman Sirocco said that he would be available to chat with constituents this morning from 9 to 11 at Lucky One's Coffee. The Catholic Church is in the midst of a century-old process of transition following the death of Pope Francis at 88. Joining me in the studio to talk about the role of the Pope in the Church, and more importantly, about the day-to-day lives of Catholics in terms of the impact of the Pope, we have Justin Hibbert of St. Mary's Catholic Church here in Park City. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
You know, before we plunge into substance, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your role at the church?
Sure. I grew up actually as a Protestant. I spent 39 years in various Protestant communities. I was a Baptist minister for 11 years. But a handful of years ago, I converted to Catholicism here at St. Mary's in Park City. I'm the host of the Why Catholic podcast, and I'm part of a great staff at St. Mary's. I do a little bit of development, some marriage prep, and I co-teach our program for adult converts.
So can you tell us, a formal matter, we all know that the Pope is the head of the church. What does that phrase mean in reality?
Well, using a political term, it really means that he is the absolute monarch. The paradox, of course, is that he is the absolute monarch of the smallest country in the world, of a population of exactly zero people. So that's politically speaking. But in reality, he is the head pastor of the oldest and largest institution in the world with 1.4 billion parishioners. So he is the successor of St. Peter, whom Jesus appointed to be the first leader of the Christian church. And this is why cardinals take a long time to really discern who they want to elect, because the Pope has a lot of power, and the last thing we want is a Pope that comes in and wields all that power. I think G.K. Chesterton said it best, is that you want the type of leader that doesn't think he can be the leader. So I think President Trump the other day said, I would like to be Pope. That's the person you don't want to elect the Pope.
It's interesting. So you want to elect somebody who doesn't want the job.
Correct.
But would be willing to do it if called upon.
Absolutely.
And I guess anyone who is dedicated their life to the church, by the time you become a cardinal, that's obviously a very deep and lifelong commitment. How many cardinals are there?
Oh, there's 200 and something, but at the end of the day, only those who are under the age of 80 can elect a pope, so there are 100 and something cardinal electors.
Okay. How significant a pope was Pope Francis, and what changes did he bring to the church?
I think it'll take time to understand Pope Francis's impact overall. Some of that is because it'll take time to see what his successors choose to continue doing. I think in general, there's a general agreement that Pope Francis's greatest gift to the church was that he was a pastor. He really focused on conveying the mercy of God to people. I think for me personally, I was always impressed by the way that he refused to just preach to the choir. Instead, he really spoke to the crowd. And so I think that's probably the greatest legacy that he has on the church, whether you were his supporter or his critic. That was something that really stood out to people.
You know, one of the things that you read about him is that he lived the walk. That is, I take it there are options as to where a pope could live physically. There are options as to how a pope could move physically. And he chose to be humble, didn't he?
He sure did. I think that was something that stood out to me. I was a Protestant at the time. I would say probably anti-Catholic. And when Pope Francis was elected, I was just drawn to his humility. So right from the get-go, he said, you know, I don't want to live in the papal apartment. I want to live in a much more humble place. I want to smell like the sheep. And that's really what the calling of a pastor is. On Holy Thursday every year, the day before Good Friday, at the local parishes, priests will wash the feet of parishioners. And Pope Francis made it a habit of going to the prisons and washing the feet of prisoners. He did that even 4 days before his death. He went to the prison. So I think that's the type of legacy the impact he has definitely left on the church. I'm curious to see if the next pope will continue in that fashion. I think there were some other changes that the pope made. One was the government structure of the church. I don't know how significant this was, but he changed a little bit of the government structure. He consolidated some things. But I probably the most significant change was that he allowed for lay people to be the leader of what's called these dicasteries, these ministries that oversee the structure of the Vatican. And so we'll see if future successors continue in that path, if they do nothing with it, if they make changes, or if they'll appoint lay people into those roles. I think another thing was maybe a negative was that he really restricted the Latin Mass. So his predecessor, Pope Benedict XVI, allowed for and actually encouraged churches to adopt the Latin Mass if they wanted to. Pope Francis saw this as a mark of disunity in some ways, and really put a lot of restrictions on the Latin Mass. And that caused some consternation with more traditionally minded people.
And I suspect there were some traditionalists who had other issues with this pope. I mean, obviously, the Latin Mass is an example. I'm sure there's some other ones.
Yeah, I would say that Pope Francis really spoke from his heart. And sometimes maybe there could have been a lot more clarity in some of his statements. And so that caused a lot of angst, I would guess, with some more traditionally minded people. I think though, some of it is that, you know, Pope Francis as a Jesuit spoke with a lot of nuance, and you know, the media would grab a hold of what he said and would run with it in one way or another, and the media not understanding theological nuance or anything like that really didn't have that context, and so then it created a frenzy maybe that didn't need to be created. So that was one thing. The other thing that Pope Francis really did, I spent the last few years on, was the Synod on Synodality, which I think is kind of a little bit like the Bodie McBoat face of names, personally. But the Synod on Synodality was really about getting local churches to listen to parishioners and the outside community, and to understand what was on their hearts and minds. And they were just listening sessions. It wasn't for the priests to debate or anything like that. And then what the local priest did was take those notes and take them to the bishops. Those bishops then compiled the notes, took them to the Vatican, and then Pope Francis invited a conglomerate of people, cardinals, bishops, but also lay people to come and to kind of flesh out some of these ideas and what's the future direction of the church, where do we feel like God is leading us. I don't know what's going to come of that. You know, will anything come of it? Will some of the ideas in there be incorporated later down the road? I think that I think time will tell. But that was a big initiative that he did, and I think it really speaks to Pope Francis really wanting to hear from the local person and really having that heart for the individual person that makes up the Catholic Church.
And that sort of leads to our natural next question, which, you know, how important is the Pope on a local level? How does he affect the day-to-day lives of your parishioners at St. Mary's, for example?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of ways. One is just his organic influence, right? We pray for the Pope every day. We see the Pope on television. You know, if you pay a lot of attention, you'll even read some of the Pope's writings. You'll listen to his addresses on Sundays at the Vatican. And so the Pope, in one sense, has that kind of organic influence as the head leader. He is, we call him our Holy Father. He, in a sense, is a father figure. This is not like a political office where half the country hates him and half the country loves him. It's not like that. It's really, this is supposed to be the person that we look up to. So that's one thing that, one way that he influences people. I'd say the other way is that the Pope can make decisions that impact the local parish, like, for example, the Synod on Synodality or the Latin Mass. I think that that's much more challenging, right? Because while the Pope is an absolute monarch of sorts, he is an absolute monarch of 1.4 billion people who are spread out in every country, who speak every language, who look different, who act different. And so he's really relying on his bishops to help to push down his agenda and his ideas. And so he has to, you know, flesh out an idea. The local bishops then have to kind of understand that idea. What's the Pope's vision here? What's he trying to say? And then they bring that to the local parishes and priests, who then, you know, decide how to incorporate those things. So there can be those changes that are made. But it takes a lot of work to make those changes happen, for sure.
And you know, if you were suddenly designated a cardinal or off to the Sistine Chapel to participate in the vote, what are the important qualities? What would be the top three qualities that you'd be looking for in the new Pope?
Well, I think first and foremost, I'm looking for someone with an attitude of holiness, right? With someone who really is authentically living a life that is like Jesus. He is ultimately the person that is leading the church in that direction. And those are the things that are going to trickle down into the other areas of life. So I think of a few things top of mind. One is that he's a pastor. He has not lost his desire to be a pastor of people, right? That's how all popes start. Well, generally, at least in the last so many years, they're priests, parish priests. And so he needs to be that. I think Pope Francis was an incredible example of this. I think secondly is theological. He needs to be a good theologian, because ultimately it's the Pope that's going to tell us what is orthodoxy and what is heresy. What are these doctrines that are getting introduced to the church? Are they compatible with what the doctrines of the church are, or are they contradictory? And I think a great example of this was Pope Benedict XVI, who was an incredible theologian, wrote 66 books, and that was his gift. A third that I think we often overlook is that he is administrative, his administrative leader. He is the supreme leader of the church. There's a reason the Vatican kind of comes to a halt when the Pope dies and people vacate their positions. So he needs to be a great administrator. And I think Pope John Paul II, He was an incredible pope. I think his administrative capabilities often get overlooked by so many of his others. I mean, it was under his tenure that his pontificate that we had the Catechism of the Catholic Church was developed, the Code of Canon Law was rewritten, the development of the papacy, that whole, you know, how do we do this? That was redone. I mean, he really spent a lot of effort on administration. If I could add two more, I would say that the Pope has to be a unifier. You know, he has 1.4 billion people around the world. How does he bring together those people from all walks of life who are even in warring countries together? Mm. How does that happen? And I think a fifth thing is that he has to be a global advocate for peace and social justice. So he's one that speaks to other world leaders and speaks to countries about what it means to be at peace, what it means to treat people with equality and graciousness.
And let's talk, just before we go, I want to talk a little bit about the legacy of the existing pope. And in that sense, and I asked you this offline, can you explain a little bit about the relationship between being a pope and being designated as a saint?
Yeah, so this is a great question. I think coming from an anti-Catholic background, you know, and from a Protestant world, we would oftentimes talk about we would study the Reformation and we'd say, oh, this is the evil thing the Pope did and that's why you shouldn't have a Pope and that type of thing. And what I learned when I became Catholic is that I think sometimes we give the Pope too much credit and how he leads the church or the influence that he has over the church, because ultimately, while the popes are the leaders of the church, the saints are the legacy of the church. So, there's a lot of popes we don't remember. There's a lot of popes we do remember. There's a lot of popes that leave their legacy in the church in good ways as well as not so good ways. But ultimately, what the church does through the canonization process, this is a process of declaring someone as a saint, as someone who is in heaven, is that we look at that individual and we say, that's the individual that we want to look up to, that we want to emulate. You know, we don't have like President's Day, like Pope Days, so like that's not something we have. But we do have a day for every single saint who is canonized. They get a particular day and we celebrate that person. And so I think one of the things is that even the popes look up to the saint. It is the goal of the Pope and really all Catholics to ultimately want to become a saint.
Okay, we've been speaking with Justin Hibbert of St. Mary's Catholic Church. Real quick before we go, Polymarket this morning opened up the opportunity for you to gamble on who can be the next pope. Do you have an inside tip for our listeners who want to make a pick?
Don't do it.
All right. Thanks for spending time with us.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Local News Hour. Right after this broadcast on the Community Campfire, you'll get to meet Doug Coleman, a stuntman and magician whose wild ride from hitchhiking to Hollywood turned into a career crashing cars. Then Mary Beth Mazares will talk about Park City song camps, and we'll also have fun facts, Coach Skinner, and fresh takes from our campfire kids. A couple hours ago, my first grandson and second grandchild was born. I am confident that he's spending this first morning, his birthday, listening to this broadcast. Welcome to the Local News Hour audience, and welcome to the world. Happy birthday.